Okay, welcome everyone. Let's start on time. We have a lot of material to cover today. First of all, today was the deadline for the last homework. Sorry, there are no late days for homework. That's a rule. But I think this was not a very difficult homework, I hope. Any issues with this homework? Transactions and query processing. Did everyone find queries that exhibited the right join algorithm? Yeah? Was it difficult? What did you do to find to get a merge join?
Join the itself.
Join it to itself?
Uh-huh. I think if you used either an inner join or something like that, you could get it out no matter what you joined, basically. It was kind of weird.
Well,
it's one of them.
You also must get a hash join. So what did you do to get a hash join? So what's the difference between... Maybe we should take this in the second half of this lecture. So that was one. Then transactions. Anybody who's confused about the principles of transaction processing that we discussed so far? Transactions are a difficult topic. This is why we have a second course offered by Phil Bernstein in the spring. What we discussed here are just the principles, just the main ideas, how they fit together. This is outside of our scope. Okay, so no more homeworks. We are done with it. But we still have one more phase of the project, and this is what kept Nguyen and Alex here busy for the last week. They worked very hard to prepare the data, to understand how to do data mining. I think they're halfway through. But now we're throwing it into your courtyard, so we are asking you to do data mining. Essentially, here is what you will do. You will run one data mining task which is given to you, and this should normally take you 10 minutes. You just follow the instruction. Don't understand too much. Just follow the instruction, and then this will incite you to think about what you're doing. And then the second task is to make a small variation, so you can try something by yourself. And then there is an open-ended task that will ask you to, which is only for extra credit, that will ask you to do something else that is interesting, whatever you find interesting. So this is the last phase of the project. It's the most... It's the least well-designed project. It's a completely new problem for us, and I hope you'll enjoy participating in the design phase. So my plan for today is this. I'm going to spend about 30 minutes or less talking about data mining. I will give you the principles. This is not a course on data mining. There is a separate course offered by Pedro Domingos on machine learning and data mining. What I want to give you is a basic algorithm which is so simple and clean that I think everybody who took a database class should know it, which is the frequent item set data mining algorithm, or the a priori algorithm. It has different names. And that's what you will use in the first task of the project. So let me start. These lectures are based on chapter 26. After this half an hour, we will switch to last week's lecture. We have a lot of material left there to cover. And in the last part, I will discuss database tuning. So this is going to be towards 9 o'clock or so. Yes?
Ramakrishna?
This is in Ramakrishna's book, yeah. Okay, so data mining. What's going on here? Here is the deal. We collect a lot of data today. And that's okay for transaction processing, which usually touches one piece of data at a time. But often you would like to learn from this large collection of data something that's interesting. How can you learn something that's interesting? This is the purpose of data mining, to extract interesting data, interesting patterns from data. And I just got this ridiculous example the slides that come with the book, it's not a very interesting one. There are much more interesting associations that we can find in the data. Now, data mining is what database people borrowed from machine learning. There is an entire field called machine learning whose purpose is precisely to design statistical models from data mining. So the way to think about this is that this is data mining, what we call in databases data mining, and this is machine learning. This is the field of machine learning. They have much more advanced techniques for learning from data. And machine learning sits inside a much bigger field, which is called statistics. And they have been doing this for 100 years. And now the machine learning people, they are relabeling this as statistics. And we database people, we are relabeling it as data mining. So I'm warning you that it's a huge field, and what I'm showing you today is very little. So what's our goal? It is to learn interesting facts from the data. And this is a nice definition of what interesting facts are. You will tell me after a week if what you're finding in the data satisfies these definitions. What we are learning should be valid, which means it should hold most of the time. It should be new. Don't tell me like all the husbands are males. This is not very interesting. It should be useful, very hard to quantify, and it should be understandable. If it has too many mathematical formulas, it's not very understandable. So there are gazillions of reasons why I use data mining today. The most important reason is because you need to solve the fourth phase of the project, which is a very important reason for using data mining. Again, there are many different machine learning methods, and most of them have found their ways somehow into the database community, and they have variations for large collections of data, then they are called data mining. We are going to focus only on association rules, but you can find brief description in the book of some of the other data mining approaches. So this is what I'm going to talk about for the next 20 minutes or so. Association rules. The reason why the database community is so excited about association rule is because, first of all, there is a very simple algorithm. And second, this very simple algorithm scales to very large data sets. Unlike many other machine learning algorithms that are mostly designed for main memory data, so they do not scale. And this is what where the database community comes in. We know how to make things scale. And the association rules, they form an approach to data mining that is especially good for scaling. And now this just repeats what I told you, that in task one, you will run an association rule task in SQL Server. Normally, you just follow the instructions. It should be done in 10 minutes if you can access the data, which is not completely ready yet. And I think the website gives you an extended deadline, but I changed my mind. I really want this to be done by next Tuesday. It's a 10-minute thing, okay? In task two, all we ask you is to do some variation on the same thing, on the same data, on the same table. This is part of the required part of the project. And then task three is open-ended. We will give you the entire data, which is actually much smaller than the denormalized table that Nguyen and Alex had to prepare in order to do data mining. So they had to do some joins, essentially cross products, to prepare this one big table where you can do data mining. This is what made the data so big. The actual data is stored nicely in a normalized fashion, and you will have access to it. If you can come up with interesting ideas, let us know. Turn them into the project. And the deadline for these phases is going to be next Saturday, which is March 10th, late in the evening. Yes?
Is it possible to get a copy of the data ourselves for local use, or is it at the standard service?
I will defer this to. You definitely can get a copy of. That's the purpose, for you to be able to get a copy so you can play with it and tell us great things. Be careful how it's for instructional purpose only. Some of this data is copy protected. As with anything you get from the department, you're aware you are not allowed to distribute it.
Just a quick question, how big is the data set?
Alex was here, who actually collected the data. He will give a brief presentation in about 25 minutes. The actual database is not that big, just a table. I'll defer this to him. What I want to do now is to make you experts in the a priori data mining algorithm that find association rules. So here is what happens. We have data that looks something like this. It's a collection of what's called transactions, but I'm going to put here quotations because they are not to be confused with the transaction in transaction processing. They are transaction in the sense of a transaction as a store. And this a priori algorithm is always described in terms of a market basket application. There are customers who come to the supermarket, and one transaction is when one customer checks out and what he bought a bunch of items. So here is how you think about the data. This is one transaction here. It has the same transaction ID. And these are the items that have been bought. And we ignore the rest. All we care is a set of items that were bought during that transaction. This is the second set of items. Then for the second transaction, this is the third transaction and the fourth transaction. That's the way we think about the data. And actually I have later a few slides further down is this picture that tells you how to think about the data when we come to the algorithm. So we have a set of transactions, and every transaction is a set of items. Think of the basket. This is what the customer showed at checkout. Okay, so now what do we want to do with it? So we want to find interesting co-occurrences or rules between these items. Something like this. We want to find out that 80% of all customers purchased a set of three given items. That's interesting. Maybe the store manager will take this piece of information and will do something with it. Here is what's called, so this is a co-occurrence. Here is an association rule. 60% of all customers who purchased X and Y also purchased Z. We write this like this. X, Y implies Z. Which means that customers who buy X and Y together, they tend also to buy Z. The typical example that people gave in the early 90s when they discovered this a priori algorithm was the diapers beer association. So the rules that they discovered, they actually didn't publish in the paper, they have more boring things, but they discovered this. Diapers implies beer. So what do you think that happens? Who buys diapers? The young fathers who are sent to the supermarket to get diapers, when they are happy, and they also grab a six-pack. So this was an important piece of information. Apparently, if you go to the supermarket, you now find them, many supermarkets, you find them close together. So, but notice this, the opposite doesn't hold. Beer doesn't imply diapers. And that's because there are many people who buy beer, but not all of them buy, only a small fragment buy diapers. Okay, so what we want to find are these rules. X implies Y, where X is a set of items and Y is another set of items. There are two parameters. There are two quality measures for this, for such a rule. The first is the confidence. The confidence is a probability that if as a set of items X occurs, then the set, then the, also the set of items I also occurs. Let me actually start with support, which is much easier to understand. The support is simply the probability that the combination XI occurs together. So let me describe this with a diapers beer thing. Diapers beer. What is the support? You look at the set of all transactions and you compute how many of them contain what? Both diapers and beer together. And if you only find two, then this rule doesn't have a support. Even if in both of them, you need to have enough of them out of the total number of transactions to justify this rule. What is enough? This you have to ask a statistician. But think of it like 10% or 1% of the data, but not 0.0001% of the data. So this is the support. Now the support, the way we are going to compute this is we are going to denote with SUPP from support of X and Y. This is the number of transactions that contain both X and Y. And now we need to divide this by what? By the total number of transactions, which is this. It's very, very simple. The whole math in a priori is very simple. Okay, now what is the confidence? The confidence is this. Out of the transactions that that contain diapers, and I'm going to throw away all the others. So I'm going to focus only on the transactions that contain diapers. What is the fraction that also contain beer? This is a conditional probability. Now, you remember your probability theory. This conditional probability is equal to what expression? It's equal to a fraction. The conditional probability of y given
x by dy.
The probability of x y divided by the probability of x. Sorry? This is, yeah, this is the base rule. Exactly. So now, if you remember that each of these probabilities is a support divided by n, and it's the same, then this turns out to be exactly the support of xy by the support of x. And when you read it, it's exactly what I said. Out of the transactions that bought x, that bought diapers, how many bought diapers and beer together? We want this to be high. We want this to be like 80%. And then we say, yep, people who buy diapers, they also buy beer. While the support, we don't insist on 80% because many people go to the supermarket and probably only a small fraction buy beer or buy diapers. But we do want a meaningful support. Okay, so keep in mind these two parameters. So how does, so this is a bunch of examples. For example, in this table, the support of pen implies milk is 75%. Why is that? How many transactions? How do you compute the support of this rule?
Three transactions by both pen and milk divided by four total transactions.
Pen and milk occur in the first one, in the second one, and in the third one. So therefore, the support of pen milk is 3 by 4, which is 75%. What is the confidence of this rule? And it's not the same thing. We look at, it happens to be the same thing, sorry.
Right. Just trying to say that.
But this is because we need to compute the support of pen and milk together by the support of pen. And it just happens so that pen occurs everywhere. Okay. And there is another example here. Let me see. Okay, I'd like to spend some time on this slide. So our goal here is this. We want to find all item sets with support greater than 75%. And let me just disclose to you. The whole algorithm actually focuses only on item sets, on finding these sets. And then the rules, they follow easily from the item sets. So what we want here is to find all sets of items X such that support of X is greater than 3. There are many such sets. X is a set. So, and we have how many types of items? Pen, ink, milk, juice. That's it, only 4. We're lucky. And in practice, there are like 10,000, right? Because there are so many items that your customer might buy. And we need to try all sets. How many subsets do you have if you have 10,000 different products? 2 to the power 10,000. So it's a non-starter. Okay? But we would start from the big sets or from the small sets? Small sets. So let's start from the very small sets. Let's start with juice. What is the support of juice? It's 2. So does juice qualify? No, because juice only occurs here and here. Let's start with milk. What is the support of milk? That's a 3. And so on. We can exhaust all the sets of size 1. Now we move to sets of size 2. And my question is, and this is the only key insight in the a priori algorithm, do we need to consider the combination juice and milk together? So remember, we got rid of milk because that was too small. Now I'm looking at for sets, item sets of size 2. I still insist that your support be bigger than 3. Does it make to consider the set juice, milk together? No. Who can explain to me why not?
There are only 2 juices, so you can't possibly have 3 sets that include juice and milk.
Exactly. There are only 2 juices. So if you're looking for juice and milk together, they can't be more than 2. So we can get rid of this. And that is the idea that helps us reduce the number of item sets that we are exploring. So, briefly, the algorithm. The algorithm operates on a table that looks like this. It's not exactly a relational table. A relational table looks like the one I showed you previously, but this is the way we think about the frequent item set algorithm. So there are a number of transactions, and each transaction has a set of items. Its goal is to find, let me go back, its goal is to find all sets of items I such that the support of I is greater than some given parameter, S. How does the algorithm proceed? It always starts from the item sets of size 1. There are only 10,000 of them, lots of them, but we can still keep in memory account for each of these 10,000. How do you compute the support for each of the 10,000 products if you have a huge file? You just do a sequential scan of the whole file. This is data mining. It doesn't have to be instantaneous. It can last for a whole day. So do a sequential scan of the whole file and just count them. But it's important for these 10,000 items to fit in my memory. So when you do a scan over the data, you have them, and you don't have to do additional disk accesses. Good. So now we have the support for all item sets of size 1. And you saw the trick. We immediately remove those that have that don't make it. They don't get over our threshold S. This is the first step of the algorithm. Is it clear what we are doing? Good. So now what is the why do I have it twice? I don't understand. So now what do we need to do? We need to examine larger and larger item sets. And the observation that we already made is this, that if we consider a larger item set I prime that contains a smaller item set I, then the support of I is greater than or equal to the support of I prime. Is it monotone? It has a different name. The support function is not monotone. It's what? It's anti-monotone. Because you give it a larger set, it will return a smaller support. The larger the set, the fewer transactions will contain that set. It's anti-monotone. Just to make sure that we are on the same wavelength here. Without looking at the data, tell me which of these two is bigger, support of pen or support of pen and beer? Support of pen is greater than or equal to support of pen and beer. Okay. So now how does the algorithm go? Actually, I have a whole algorithm here. So we start with singleton sets, and we do one pass over the data, and we retain only those that have support, at least our min support. And then we repeat, increasing the size of C sets. At each K, we increase the size of the sets of the sets by 1. So how do we do this? For each K, we look at the item sets of size K that we had already, and we expand them with one more item in all possible ways. It's an exhaustive algorithm at this level. But remember that we don't have all the item sets of size K, only those that for which we already know that they have high support. So now we need to keep all these item sets of size K plus 1 in main memory, and we do again a full pass over the data. And we just count. For each of them, we count how often it occurs. You can imagine so many optimizations. People have published hundreds of papers on optimizing this basic idea. And at the end, we just examine these remaining sets, and some of them, after we counted, they didn't make it to the min support. We just drop them, and we go to the next K. Every time we increase K, we need to do a full scan over the data. And we stop when we don't discover any new item set with the minimum support. So this is the algorithm that's described in the book. You also have it on the slides. I want you to know it. So I'm taking the freedom to give ask a question on the panel about this algorithm. It's very simple, very straightforward, and you will benefit from understanding it. Any questions about it? But we are not done yet, right? This only computes item sets of large support. What do we need to compute to finish the association rules? we need to find the association rules and their corresponding competences. How do we do this? Well, we only look for sets for which, for rules for which X and Y have high support. And then we know how to compute the confidence. It's just this ratio. And we already have in main memory the supports that we just computed. Good. So, how do we use data mining? We use it in the project. We will use it through the Business Intelligence Studio, which unfortunately is not installed yet on the instructional machine on ARIA. Some of you may have it already. We are asking support to install it. We have it on some labs, but we don't have it on ARIA yet. How many people rely on ARIA to do their project and their homeworks? Okay, so we must have it installed, and we will have it. So right now you cannot run the data mining algorithms because they are not there. It's a drag and drop interface. You don't have to implement this algorithm, so don't be concerned. It's already implemented, and you just need to drag and drop in order to use it in the Business Intelligence Studio. There is a tutorial on SQL Server data mining tools, which I printed. I didn't find it quite useful. It shows a lot of windows. Doesn't tell you too much. And now we are going to give you a short demo. Yes, there was a question.
I just had a question about the algorithm. So when you're on step three, so you have two items in all your previous sets, and you're going to create sets with three items. What do you look at? Do you look at only? Do you always look at k, or like the sets of one, or do you look at the whatever steps are on minus one? Find sets to add to it.
So let me try to repeat this question, and everybody should try to answer. So suppose we have already computed all item sets of high support of size up to 3, right? So now we'd like to move on to the next step and look for item sets of with high support of size 4. Which ones will we inspect? How can you find the candidates? Which ones?
All combinations of 4 atoms.
All combinations of 4 atoms?
Just the set of the ones that had the higher confidence at the previous step?
Well, yeah, but they were of size 3. Yeah. So let's suppose that I found these sets as having high support.
Dan?
Yes.
The live webcast does not show what you are writing on the tablet computer.
Yes, this is true. Oh, this one doesn't show up?
Yeah, I mean the live webcast. So some students send me an email.
Oh, at Microsoft, do you see the ink?
Yes.
On the live webcast, so on the web they can see it. So people are home.
I'm not sure if they are supposed to see it or not.
They are in the viewer.
You can see it. I do it normally. Yeah. You can see what you like.
Okay. So Rod, you hear me? We have a problem on live cast.
I think I heard an okay back there.
Yeah. I wonder whether to proceed. Let's. I don't think we have a choice. We just have to go on. So these are the... Let me add another one. D, E, G. We discovered that these are the only sets of size 3 that have high support. Which sets of size 4 should we inspect now? You tell me. I'm going to write them here. Well, here is one choice.
A, B, C, D.
M, N... OP. Do we inspect this one?
No.
No way. Give me a better one.
A, B, C, D.
A, B, C, D. How did you get there?
You started with A, B, C.
Start with A, B, C. And then extend it with D. But I can also extend A, B, C with something else. With what?
A, B, F, or J.
With A, B, C, E. And so on. And now, this is how people write papers in the database community. Now, if you look at this one, at this set, you discover that no. Actually, you can further improve this algorithm and drop this set. Why is that?
Because D doesn't have support of at least four.
Because I can look at another subset like BCD. In order for the set ABCD to have high support, all its subsets of size 3 must have high support, including BCD. But BCD is not on this list. So this one you can actually drop. So once you realize this higher standard, if you look at my particular example, I don't think you can find anything.
A, D, E, G.
A, D, E, G. Could be. A, D, E. What about A, D, G?
Or G, E, G.
So this one doesn't work either. It's a very high bar. So this is why data mining works, because with these pruning techniques, you can be very effective at narrowing down the set of item sets that you're inspecting. Good. So now, there is one more question. Yeah?
On a previous slide, you used the metric support in two different ways. One is an integer and one is a probability. Which one is it?
Yeah, I'm sorry for this ambiguity. It's true. So I'm using support in two different ways. People want to define it as a probability. But in the data mining algorithm, so here, I define it as a probability. But the algorithm can't use a probability. It needs to use it needs to count. It can divide, but it's useless. So it's much, much easier to think. When you think about the algorithm, it's much easier to think about the support as a count. Okay, so now I would like to ask Alex to come over and give us a 10-minute presentation of both the data mining tools and the data. That's you.
We need to switch on, yeah.
I'll just hold this up, I guess. Okay, so my name is Alex. I'm a research student with Professor Sushu. And I guess we kind of started working on this issue of diets and this issue of whether or not what you eat actually maps to what kind of diseases you get in the long term. So how many people here are actually trying to eat healthy? I think everybody is, and everybody has been since the beginning of time. And this has been one of the main issues in humanity, is trying to figure out what to eat and why to eat it. In his book, A Short History of Progress, Ronald Wright wrote that he found it fascinating that despite the different ecologies and despite the different cultures in different areas, many of these cultures around the world have converged to very similar diets. All of them tend to have similar components. And one of the questions that we can ask is, why such components? Why have a starch in your diet? Why have a protein source? Why have a fiber? And so these issues are things that we try to explore with in my work. Much of the field has been moving towards this issue of breaking foods down, breaking them down into vitamins and minerals and, you know, having calorie counts and carbohydrate counts. But that kind of thinking generally leads to not the full picture about foods. For example, we all know about Atkins and, you know, the idea that, you know, all you have to do to eat healthy is get rid of carbs. You know, that's not quite true. And on the other hand, you might consider that apples are not completely described by a set of vitamins and a set of calories. There's other things going on inside foods that make them more complex. So what we've tried to do is categorize diets on a larger scale and to say certain combinations within cultures have significance that is beyond what is just simply a combination of carbohydrates and calories and vitamins, and that these combinations of diets can result in significant health implications. What we try to do with our database is map these foods and combinations of foods onto certain trends in mortality, specifically chronic diseases. And the question is there some set of foods that corresponds to a lower set of mortality? So this is the kind of data that we'll be working with for your last project. Let's see. So I'll go ahead and show you a little bit of the data here. The reason we went about this is we'd really like to get statistical relationships that are interesting for nutritionists to look at. There's a whole field of study called nutritional epidemiology. This is kind of like that, but we're looking on a higher level. We're looking at groups of foods. This database here is called RouseDat. Now, I've got a bunch of tables, and not all of these are of interest, but basically, do you have the documentation up?
So there is a documentation which is on the project webpage.
Right.
You only need, if you would like to understand the data. For the project itself, you only need one single table. But the data itself is interesting, so it's worthwhile.
Yeah, so there is a description which is posted with the assignment. But yeah, so I'll show you a little bit of the raw data, or about as close to the raw data as it's going to be. Let's see. Oh, I have a mouse here. So we have collected about 50 million rows of mortality data. This is from the United Nations World Health Organization. And what basically this comprises is the mortality data for all the diseases across the entire planet for the past 50 or so years. There was a significant amount of cleaning that went into making this data into a query format. But essentially, I don't know if you guys can kind of see what this is here. We have region IDs, we have high-cause IDs, there's these different ways the United Nations categorizes things. And this is important to know about because it'll look rather incoherent without any sense of what they're doing. There's an international index of regions. Region keys will correspond to certain countries. So if you have, for example, I don't know one off the top of my head, but there are four-digit numbers that correspond to each country, so that across countries, across languages, everyone can interpret the same number.
We have the table that contains the translation here?
Yeah, sure. That's in the country table.
Okay, that's okay. Don't switch. Right. Let's look at this one.
So the high-cause table is the same. The high-cause ID is the same idea. Diseases across different languages and different countries will map to four-digit codes. So diabetes can be interpreted in China just as well as it can be interpreted in the United States because we have these unified codes. Now, there are some issues with these codes in that they have changed over time and been refined, but for our project, we're going to be restricting it to the most recent set of codes so that there'll be no confusion. That's exactly...
What is the translation from high cause into something that we can actually...
Yeah, that's in this high cause table, and that will directly translate...
Don't open it.
Okay. Well, it directly translates, the disease ID into the descriptions. This list is the different international classification of disease or ICD lists that have this translation. And they've changed over time, but we're going to be restricting it to a list called 10M, which is the most recent one. Of course, you have the year and gender. One is male, two is female, and nine is unknown. So that's basically what gender will be. And then low age and high age. The one note I would make is that for 0 to 100, this age bracket, that represents all the mortality. That's just kind of something we define. 0 to 100 is everything in the population. So if you're looking for a summary, you would go to 0 to 100. And finally, we have kind of the number of mortality here. The other table I'll show you is the food table.
What is mortality here? How is this?
This is per capita. So... And there's a E-6 here, but the idea is that there's a certain amount of there's a certain rate of mortality within a population. And what we've done is we've gone ahead and divided that by the population number. So what you have is a per capita death from diseases. So per person, how many people are dying from a given disease?
So low age and high age is a range.
Yes.
And what's the low-cause ID?
So low-cause ID is this notion that there's a hierarchical breakdown of disease listings. So you've got maybe cancer, and then you can break that down into different types of cancer. There's that hierarchy within the international classification of diseases. What we've done, we've tried to simplify it for you and only use high-cause IDs. When you get into the low-cause IDs, it gets a little complicated because you have to join.
So the low age and high age is the range which for that particular cause of death?
So you can break down like the number of people who died from diabetes between 0 and 5, between 5 and 10 for a given year, you know. Uh-huh. So you it breaks it into segments. If you want everyone, you go 0 to 100. The other table that you may all be interested in is the final food table, which is basically regions, food groups, years, and then numbers. And what we've done for the one that you'll be getting is we've gone ahead and divided this number into per capita again. And what we've also done for you to make data mining a little simpler is we've put these numbers into buckets. So we took the range of consumption, and then we put them into low, medium, and high. And so what the data mining algorithm will be able to do is then just see, you know, low, medium, and high, and then it's easier to determine what types of things match up with each other. So I'll go ahead and...
Show us the big table now.
Oh, the big table, right.
So you don't need any of this. You need a single table.
Right.
Which is essentially the join of these big, of these tables, the cross product.
It is an enormous table. So what we went ahead and did, as you can see, we've got the low and medium and stuff in here, is cross-product these tables, and this is with the buckets. So you're able to directly run data mining on this table, and it's far simpler than trying to join yourself.
I just want to make a note that if you open a table like this, you want to probably stop it, because otherwise it will retrieve up to infinite number of the rows on your machine, or the SQL server would probably be...
Right, okay.
So Alex, can you now answer the question that we had earlier? How big is the data?
Okay, so we have about 50 million data rows for mortality, and then we have several, almost a million data rows for food, and we're adding more in. So there's about 50 years of food and mortality data for the entire world for every single country, and we gave you a subset of that because that's not something you want to be running data mining over all the day long.
But let's be honest, because we try to compute the product of all of it, and there is no way we can compute it. So the big table is only a small subset.
Right. So the subset that we've given you is the past 10 years for only high causes, for only tables, only countries that reported population data. So it is a very, very subsetted subset.
But Alex, so this subset is only in the big table.
Right.
The other table that you're putting on the project, that's the complete data.
Yes.
So you have the full opportunity to get on the front page of the New York Times if you discover an interesting association. You have the full data there.
That's right.
It's a matter of the 10 years you need to work on it.
There is a lot of data in here, and you know, as Professor Sushi mentioned, this is kind of one of the motivations for data mining, is finding the interesting trends within kind of this really large set of data.
So for the low age, high age, so when you have 0 to 100, is that basically a superset of
Yeah.
So you'd want to use one or the other, not both.
Right, right. 0 to 100 is the collection of. So I'm going to go ahead and show the data mining, and this is pretty similar to what you guys are going to need to do. Oh, did it? Okay. Yeah. So this is SQL Server Business Intelligence Studio. If you're able to download a plugin for Visual Studio that basically will run this, and it comes with SQL Server Business Edition. Let's see. So what you'll want to do is create a project of type Analysis Services Project, and let's go ahead and run through this. And you want to create a new data source, which I've already entered here, but you'll enter this as iProjectServe, or and then you know have your credentials and. and you'll want to create a new data source view on that data source. And this is the tables that you're interested in. So for us, we're just going to use this eBigTable3, which is the cross-product table that I showed you guys. And you'll have to ignore the kind of scratch tables we put in there. Let's see. And then you're going to need a mining structure. This is kind of the meat of the assignment. And I don't know what particular one. So you want to show them analysis or association rules? Or?
Association rules, yeah.
Okay.
The first task asks you to do exactly this, to do the synthesis of clicks and construct an association rule task.
Right. So this case table is going to be the main table that we're interested in, and for this one we only have one table. And I guess we can predict food. You want
to? So this is where it's a little bit mysterious for us. I think when they say what to predict,
right,
is the why and the association rule. So you would need to predict mortality, right? You want to see which are the food groups that cause high mortality because you don't want to eat them. But now, because we don't want to give away the project, Alex will click on something else. He would.
Yeah, I'll predict food estimate then.
Yeah,
I'll predict
food.
Sure. And then, not all of these are going to be important to the data, so actually this is going to be a key.
Somewhere you need to choose a key. Where do you choose a key?
I put it as the region ID.
So this is important. Remember how the data was structured in our first example. We didn't have sets of items, but we had sets of records that share the same key. We need to specify the key ID, so SQL Server knows how to group the records.
So what's the key for us here?
The region ID. Because for each region, we are interested in this association between foods and mortality.
Right. And so for this, we are choosing all the contents types to be discrete because the association rules will have an easier time associating things if they're discrete. So I'm going to go ahead and run this, and it'll be about 5 minutes or so.
5 minutes?
Or,
okay.
Yeah. And then you just want to process the mining structure. And, okay, where'd it go? Oh, there we go. Yep, so it's going to run. Should we take questions?
Yeah, so actually I had them. So we learned a lot of things playing with this data. So one thing was this. The data comes with detailed information about, like for instance, food consumption. So it gives you a number. Now, if you want to use that number for association rules, it's a bad idea, because the crux in data mining is to find a repeated pattern, patterns that occur often. And the pattern that the consumption was exactly this value per capita will not occur too often. What will occur often is a high value of the consumption of that particular food group per capita in many years in the same region. So what you need to do, you need to bucketize. And this is what we did. We bucketized the data into low, medium, and high. Low consumption, medium consumption, and high consumption. And similarly for mortality. Low mortality, medium mortality, high mortality.
Right?
Yeah. Now it can find interesting associations. Is it working?
Yeah, it should be done. It only takes a few minutes to run, usually.
I'm actually not completely convinced that association rules are the best model to proceed about this data. And this is why we have this basic task three of the project, which is open-ended. You tell me if there is a better way to analyze data.
So what about the phase two? Do we just, it's not clear to me right now, maybe if I go home and get this guy again. Do something different, slightly different, but not much.
Here is my conjecture. Since we didn't have time to think about it, we barely had time to prepare the data. The task we prepared in task one, I don't think it's the most intelligent one. This could occur in 2 days when we start getting emails from you. Why do we do it this way? But there is a better way. I'm sure there is a better way. This is going to be tasked with today. So yet to be determined, better way to find this data.
So the data mining finished, if you want to think about it.
So not clear how the task 2 is going to differ from task 3.
In task 2, you just click on different fields. It's not going to. It's not a major difference.
Okay.
But for task 3, we will have a much higher bar. We would really look at what you're reporting is interesting. That's the only difference. That's interesting. What did you say?
So these are factors that predict a high consumption of food, or that frequently occur with a high amount of food. So you can see there are certain food groups here that are consumed in large quantities very frequently. And then you can also see that there are some disease causes which are frequently also associated with high amounts of food consumption.
Can you read that? It's impossible to read on the screen.
Okay, so let me zoom in a bit here. So let's see, there's coffee here. Which tends to indicate high amounts of food consumption, apparently. And you'll notice that a lot of these years that are around here are recent years, which would make sense because more recent years tend to have higher amounts of food consumption than years before. And I guess, let's see, being male apparently corresponds with high amounts of food consumption. there's other things in here that are pretty interesting. If you wanted to, say, look up what this high cause ID was, you would go to the high cause ID table and find the corresponding disease that corresponded with high cause ID.
So that's just a number right here, right?
Yeah.
High cause ID is 400 or...
Or A35.
Exactly.
And it could correspond with something like diabetes or, you know, something interesting like that. Or it could just be random.
Oh, so that's another way to proceed. Take this big table, join it with high cause, so we can actually get the real name of the disease. This you can turn in for phase for class 2.
Yeah.
Right, the better data mining step. Any more questions while we still have Alex here?
So you give password in the class?
Yeah, but I'm... We changed, so we are going to continue to work on iProject. Right, you finish copying.
I will continue to copy after he logged off.
Oh, right.
We are allowed to only two users are allowed to remote log in on one bullet. We have lots of limitations.
So close this.
Any more questions?
Log off.
Okay, thank you, Alex.
Thanks.
Thank you. So now, I would like to, I need process with query execution and query optimization. Talk about diseases and associations between the food groups, but we really need to prepare for the final. And the final will talk more about. Oops. The final will talk about. Query optimization and query execution, and not about diseases. So we are going to continue from where we left off last time. Which is actually not here. Why did I lose it? Yep. We left off exactly here. So let me summarize. We have seen a number of... go one step further back. How do we evaluate an SQL query? We translate this into a plan, which is called the logical plan. From the logical plan, we translate it into something which is called the physical plan.
Let me start from here. Let me ask you, what is the difference between a logical operator and a physical operator?
Well, there are more than one way to implement a logical operator.
Yes, there are more than one ways to implement a logical operator. Let's think about an example. What's an example of a logical operator? Join. What is an example of a physical operator? Merge join. Okay, you actually did the homework, so you know this. Merge join, hash join, and everything that's here. So, okay, so we discussed these choices. What I would like to do now is examine how these choices interact, kind of preparing the ground for discussing an optimizer. And I have this example, for which I have lots of wonderful slides, that does a single join between products and companies, and we should discuss how a query processor might execute this query. Okay, so let's study this in detail. So we have a table product, and the key is product name, and there is company whose key is company name. And of course, the maker is a foreign key into company. Okay, it's our standard database schema. And let's assume we have all the indexes we can dream of. There is an index on pname. What kind of index is this, clustered or unclustered? This is probably clustered. There is an index on maker, which is unclustered. There is an index on CNAME, which is clustered, and an index on city, which is unclustered. So we have everything we ever wished. We need to find all product names of those products that are manufactured by a company in Seattle. How can we execute this query? Well, let me start with the basics. We discussed this. We assume that we have clustered and unclustered indexes. The basics is to translate the query into a logical plan. And here it is. In this case, we don't have too many options. There is this plan, and there is only one second plan that we can consider. Which one? The selection after the join. And if you remember, this affects our ability to use or not to use indexes. But we are going to stick to this one and kind of cheat, go through the selection if we really need to access the index. Okay, so now on this slide, let's discuss what are the choices for the physical join. How would you implement this join? There are many possibilities. Let's pick one and discuss exactly what would happen. That's the way I'd like to proceed. Hash join. Let's do a hash join. So what we need to do to do a hash join? We would have to for which table will we construct the hash table? The smallest one. Let's guess. So we don't discuss too many choices. Select on company. That would be the smallest one. But then that begs the question, how are we going to do the selection? Do we scan? What's the other choice?
Seek index.
Use the index on city, which is the unclustered index. This gives us all the pointers to all the records that are in Seattle. So then we have to jump back and forth in the file and read those records, all the records of companies that are in Seattle, and we get them right here. So there is some cost that we need to be aware of just reading these records, because we don't read them sequentially. We get them with random accesses. But now we have them. We can construct the hash table right here. And then we iterate over a product, just a linear scan, and we probe, and we are done. This is one plan. And guess what? This is not I prepared two plans, and I didn't capture that one. The first one I captured was an index-based join. And notice that here I actually switched them. So since joins are non-commutative, the optimizer actually has to consider both cases, A join B and B join A. So who can describe to me what's going on here? This is still an index-based selection, exactly like we did before. So it uses the unclustered index to find all companies that live in Seattle. But now the join differs. What does it do? It gets these records one by one. Here are the records that go up to the join. So what does it do with each record, with each company in Seattle?
It's the index of the companies.
Exactly. It goes here, and it accesses the index on Maker, which is still the unclustered index, and it gets back all the products, and there are probably many products for that company that are made by this particular company. And it just combines them and returns the result. So we used two indexes, and both of them were unclustered. Okay, LAN2. So here I propose a merge join. And actually there are two variations for this merge join. Of course there is an index join in the other way. There are so many different choices. Let's look at the merge join. So how does this one work? In order to do this join, we need to sort both the product and the company. We need to sort the product based on maker and the company on CNAME. Okay, so now we have two choices. In both cases we have two choices. So look at product. How can we sort on maker? How does a product sit on disk? Isn't it already sorted? Sorry? It's sorted by pname. It's sorted in the wrong order. So what can we do to sort it? If you remember, merge join does the initial run formation, so reads in main memory. Imagine that product is a big table. It doesn't fit in main memory. But we will read chunks of size M, creates the initial runs, sends it to disk, and now we don't have to actually sort them. We have these runs that are ready to be merged, so we can do the sorting. This plan. And what would be the cost? How many disk IOs do we need to do?
Three.
3B of product. Because we need to read in main memory, sort, write to disk, and then the next step we will read in order to send the records now in sorted order to the join. But there is another way in which we can sort, and that's captured here. What does this say?
Scan the unclustered index.
Scan the unclustered index, which is a B-tree, will give us a maker in increasing order. But then we have to access them in a random fashion, which is not necessarily a good idea. But we can postpone accessing them, maybe. But we don't discuss that. Okay, how do we sort company? It's already sorted by CNAME, so here we can actually, so we do an index scan. Index scan here just means read the table, because the table itself is its primary index. And this returns the companies sorted by CNAME. And now we just filter, we eliminate those that don't live in Seattle. Did we use the index now on city? No, we didn't use the index. What if you wanted to use the index? We could use the index.
And C name is out of order when you get to the merge.
And then we have no guarantee what's the C name. Actually, we might have a guarantee. It depends on how those pointers are stored for all the cities in Seattle. But otherwise, we need to sort them. If we know there aren't too many, then we are in good shape. We just sort them in main memory and it's okay. But if there are too many, then we need to sort where previously we had them already sorted. These are the trade-offs. And finally, we can merge. Good. So what we have to do? We have to analyze these two plans, which are actually three. And yeah, I think we have time to look at this. So remember the first one, which did an index join. Let's see its cost. The index space selection. What is the cost of finding all records? What is the cost of sending here up this pipeline all the records of all companies that live in Seattle? Well, we can access them directly. We never account for the cost of accessing the index. But we do need to account for the cost of accessing these records, and they will be accessed in random order. So every dot here is one disk access, because they come from different blocks on disk. So how many dots do we get? That's a number. The total number of companies divided by what was V of company in city?
What's V?
What is V?
What is the number of companies?
This is the total number of the number of distinct values of city. The number of cities. So this assumes a uniform distribution. And it just says if you want the companies in one particular city, this is the number of tuples I estimate will be returned. And each of them means one disk access. Okay, now for each of them, we need to go to product and do a direct access and find all the makers. For each maker, for each product that's made by that company, we need a different disk access. How many do we need to do? That's a number. Same argument. Total number of products divided by the total number of makers. So we multiply them, and this is the total cost. Okay, for the other plan. So here is the cost for the other plan. Let's just discuss one of them. Then it really gets boring. So we saw this one, scan and sort. So scan and sort costs 3B of product. We discussed this already. So what we do here, we decided to go with a table scan, which means B of company. And now there is a merge join, and here there is no extra cost. Why is there no extra cost? Because we assume we don't send them back to this. Maybe we just send them to the client. Or we feed them into the next operator. So what would the optimizer do? Which one would it choose?
Costs.
Exactly. The optimizer needs to estimate these costs and then choose the cheapest one. And that's my main message. It all depends on the data. This is what makes databases so different from the algorithm or the data structures class. In that class, there is always a best algorithm. There is a best algorithm for finding the shortest graph in a shortest path in a graph. There is a best algorithm for multiplying two matrices. Which one is that? Strassen's algorithm, whatever. There is always a best one, right? Once you get to the lowest asymptotic running times, that's the best one. And databases is different. It's a totally different mindset. There is no best one. We are always trying to use the current state of the database, the statistics that we have, in order to choose which one is the best one for this particular data. Okay, so we actually plugged in some numbers to see what happens. I don't think it's so interesting. So let's skip this. So we saw the lessons. So this leads us into the next chapter, which is query optimization. What we discussed so far is just how to implement each individual logical operator. Now we will discuss how to choose between different plans, different logical and physical plans, how to choose the cheapest one. This has the most limited applicability for most of you. It's also the most, complex part of a database management system. There is no simple solution. We will discuss essentially approaches, and we will discuss the algorithm that was proposed and implemented in the early system R. That essentially defined how to approach a database optimizer. Since then, most major vendors, actually only the two ones, SQL Server and DB2, they have advanced their optimization algorithms considerably. So it's no longer based on systems R. Oracle still has a very poor optimizer. Their focus is on transaction processing. So this is why I'm not going to spend too much time on the query optimizer. And you won't walk today out of this room being ready to write a query optimizer. But I think you will get an appreciation of what it takes to build one. And you will be well prepared to answer any questions on the final, of which there will be some on query optimization. So here is a general idea. We create a plan, which is an initial plan for the query. And now we look at finding alternative plans, and we just choose the cheapest one. The essence of query optimization is very simple. How can we find alternative plans?
Substitute equivalent physical operators for the logical ones.
So freeze a logical plan, and now consider various physical operators for the for each logical operator. This right. is true. This is what we did on the previous example. What I didn't show you on the previous example is how to deal with a much more complex query that admits different logical plans. How can you iterate over those? That's more tricky, yes.
Well, maybe could you come up first from a SQL statement, maybe try to come up with different versions of that, from there create different logical plans, and then from each logical plans and create different physical plans. And
That's a very good suggestion. So from the query, have an algorithm that's able to produce not just one single plan, but alternative plans. Interestingly, this is not how Query Optimizer decided to do it. Although I agree, it's a very logical approach. The way they decided to do it is just generate one, and then they apply algebraic laws to generate others. What is an example of an algebraic law? Commutativity, associativity, and so on. So this is something that we will discuss in a few slides. Okay, so let's see an example. Actually, we saw this already, right? The idea here is that you can take the selection and push it down over the join. And this is a better logical plan. Here is one we haven't discussed. It's a little puzzle for you. Here is a query. It's a simple group by query with a having clause. It has one single logical plan. I can't think of another one. Actually, I can think of another one. And my question is, what is another logical plan that is better, in quote, than this logical plan? Better in quotes because we can never be sure unless, until we look at the physical operators. So let's read this. It starts from the Sears table. It groups by city and computes the sum of quantities it puts in P, and then selects only those for which P is less than 100, because it wants only those groups whose sum of quantities is less than 100.
So we can check the quantity rather than the sum.
That's the idea. So that means we introduce a new operator, which sits right here. And what does it do?
Selects a quantity less than 100.
Quantity less than 100. That's an interesting optimization, little cute idea. So expect very, very advanced optimizers to do all sorts of these unexpected hacks that improve the query. And I will show you another one, which is quite spectacular. Okay, so let me skip this, if you saw this. So here is where we start in series. There are three components to a query optimizer. There is a set of algebraic laws. The more we throw at the optimizer, the better it will be to discover alternative logical and physical plans. Then there is an optimization algorithm. So the algebraic laws, I'm going to describe them to you in a satisfactory way. The optimization algorithm, not so much. I will describe to you a very restricted one, and will only hand wave how the others do. And there is a cost optimizer, a cost estimator, sorry. There is a cost estimation module whose purpose is to estimate the cost of each of the alternative plans. And similarly here, I think actually I can describe this to you in enough detail so you can actually implement it if you need to do this. So I realize now it's time to take a break. Maybe let's take a break for 7 minutes, and then we'll start discussing algebraic laws. Okay, folks, I think it's time to start. Can you hear me at Microsoft? Okay. So we still have plenty to cover, but the material we have to cover is not that deep. Maybe it's the statistics. They are a little bit harder to get. So algebraic laws. Let me start with the simple ones. Commutativity and associativity, they are what they are. We know them. Distributivity means that join distributes over union. So let me not spend too much time on them. Laws that involve selections. This is what we saw. This is the mass expression that says that you can push selections down. How did it say so? It says that if you select on a condition after you apply a join, and if that condition only refers to the left table or to the left expression, then you can apply the selection first and then apply the join. That's what it says. It's also repeated here for some reason. This is not an exhaustive list of laws. Let me show more interesting. I wanted to go through this. So, how would you push a selection down here in the first example? This is equivalent to what expression? So this expression performs a join. By the way, this is join. It performs a join between R and S on D equals E. And then it selects only those entries that have F equals 3. So let's do the selection of F equals 3 on S first, and then join the result B equals E with R. That's what it is. What does the second expression translate to? I mean, rewrite to.
To a selection on R of E equals 5, and also a selection on F equals 9, and then join them on D equals 8.
Right? And then we join, right? And arguably this is more efficient than the first one, except this issue with joins. Good. Projections. Projections. Recall that in the logical, in the extended algebra, in the BAG algebra, projections only remove columns. They do not do duplicate elimination. And therefore, we have to remember to do duplicate elimination later. And what happens here is that we can remove columns early if we know we don't need them later on. Let's look at the example here, and you tell me which columns can we remove from R. I mean, which columns do we need to retain from R, and which ones can we get off before? And similarly here for S. What do I write here?
Get rid of A and B from R.
Can you say again, please?
So get rid of A and B from R.
Get rid of A and B. I wouldn't get rid of A and B.
Keep them.
We need to keep A and B. So.
I'm sorry. Get rid of C and D from R.
We keep A and B, and we also keep what?
D.
We also need to keep D because of this join. And in S, we do what?
Get rid of F and G.
We keep E, and we keep G, because we need it at the end. And in the end, we keep which field?
ABG,
same as before. This is why in the law at the top, this M is the same as this M. We keep the same set of attributes in the end. Very simple. This is just projection. Here is an interesting slide. This is really interesting. I'd like to describe this to you on this example here. I'd like to show this to you on a fresh slide. But let me remember what we are doing. Okay, so here is what we are doing. We have this table R with attributes A and B. So it has A prime, A double prime, and then this is S, C and D. And the point is that these things join, and they join in a many, many way. And the goal is to group by A, and for each A to compute, what was that? Was it a sum? Some aggregate operator, but let's suppose it's a sum. For each group, I want the sum of all the D's. Okay, so and then for A prime, of course, I want the sum of those D's, which is written as follows. It's group by A and sum of D of R join S on B equals C. And the question is, how can we optimize this expression? Actually, try this. I will always care a lot about motivating this class. So when I when one of my first offerings of the undergraduate class, I try to show them why databases are great. So I said, let's do this. Let's take a many-many relationship between three tables. This is just between two, but you can imagine between three tables. Let's do a group by in one of them on an attribute on the last one. And I wanted to show them how difficult it is to how much effort it's involved to write a join and do the group by, and you have to do hash-based algorithms and so on and so on. And then I wanted to show them that the databases did do this for us. So I actually spent time and implemented the whole thing in C++. So I took three huge tables, and it was a many-many relationship. So it was something like this. And each of them had maybe 1 gigabyte or so. And this was, or maybe this was like 10 megabytes. 10 meg, and this was 1 gig. Okay, so a huge many relationship. And the group by was on an attribute from the left, counting something on the right, or summing up something on the right. And that really worked for a week. I wanted to give this as a first homework, and then I gave up. It took me a week to implement all those join algorithms and in main memory with, bucket partition. It's very messy. Okay, but I did it, and I measured it. And if you implement it without too many hacks, you just do the brute force implementation according to the book, this thing runs in about 1 minute. So after 1 week, I had a number, which was about 1 minute. This is how much time it costs you to do the 3 times traversal of these tables, which is the 3B stuff. And then I went to SQL Server, I ran it, and it took about 1 second. And then I thought, I'm going to give up. What did it do? What did SQL Server do to compute this huge three-way join and the group I in 1 second? Yeah, you can't use it with indexes, because I really designed the hash to be, I designed the join to be a huge join. Index-based join only work if you have a small table. This is when the index lookup pays off. But if the tables are big, then it better do a hash-based join. And I think it was doing a hash-based join. But it was doing something else very smart, which really didn't occur to me. It was beyond my point, but it was very smart. What was it doing?
Just looking at the distinct values, the distinct A's in this case?
Actually, let me try to guide the discussion and go back to our example. Let me make our example a little bit more concrete by giving you here companies. And this is product. So now you can imagine that every company has many products. And the next company has many products. And what we want here, we want to group by city. So there are many companies living in Seattle. And there are many companies in Portland. And for each city, we want to sum the quantities of all the products in that city. Yes, what would you do?
You could do the group by on company, so you have the sum of all the D's for C, and then you can do the join, and then just sum that.
So say again, you would do the group by where?
Like in this example, where you want the sum of D's, you group by C first.
Exactly. This is what you do. You start by a group by here in the other table. Think like doing a group by in product on the maker. So this would compute your local group here. It will consolidate these products into a single entry. And it makes a lot of sense, right? You find the total sum for each maker, and then you add up these sums for all the makers in the same city. And since sum is commutative, is associative, you get the same answer. It turns out that you don't need this elegant one-many relationship for this to hold. It also holds for a many-many relationship. And that's exactly what this equation tells us. So this says that it's equal to first to a group by C, sum of D over S. Now we do what? We join as before on C equals D with A, and now we do a group by again on A and sum of D with the other D, this sum of these. And if you have a longer chain of joins, you just repeat this. This is what SQL Server was doing on a three-way join. And you can actually try this. And I had a homework with this, but I think you had enough homeworks. But if you can get your hands on three large tables that have a many-many relationship, try this. And you'll see there that there is an extra group by. Where is it coming from? It's from here. It's doing an aggressive group by. So, that is the equation. This explains this relationship. And this is what some optimizers like SQL servers has encapsulated in their rule of algebraic laws. Good. And then I have a number of slides on semi-join optimization, which I'm planning to skip. And these are not on the final. It gets too detailed. If we have enough time at the end of the lecture, I come back to this. So we have seen the algebraic laws that an optimizer can use to rewrite a logical plan into another logical plan. Now, the second thing to discuss is what is the algorithm that the optimizer will deploy to search the space of these plans. How can it proceed? And here is where it gets a little bit vague. How can you search through the plans? Well, one alternative is to represent the entire plan, and then you have a list of rules. This is what the optimizer actually have. They have a collection, like a database of rules, these algebraic laws. And whenever somebody comes up with a clever idea like that group I, then they extend this set of rules. They add another one. And what would you do? At each step, you take one of your plans in your current list of alternative plans, and you take one of the rules, and you see if you can apply it, and then you generate a new plan. And if you consider multiple rules, then you can apply this to the same plan and generate multiple plans. It looks something like this. You hand this plan, and now you apply one rule, like associativity, it gives you this. And you apply a different rule, like this group icing, it gives you something like this. And you apply a different rule, and it gives you a different plan. So now, how do we explore these plans? You get lots of them, because when you apply these rules blindly, in the lecture, you know, we try to apply them in an intelligent way, but the optimizer doesn't know this, right? It would just apply them blindly. So how would you design the optimizer to do something smart?
Divide and conquer.
Well, for each of these plans, we can also compute the cost, right? So, and what's the danger?
Explosion.
Explosion, too many plants. That's a danger. So how can we use a cost to be clever? And I'm not looking for a perfect solution. I'm looking for a discussion.
It seems like you could abort exploring some plants if you already know that your cost is too high.
Right. For example, so if we have a cost here, and the new cost is bigger, then you can argue that we are not going to keep this plant. Yes.
But how would that work? What happens if you take that second C dash and then transform it again to something else? How do you know that you're not going to have some kind of a local, you know, that actually can be much, much less than the initial one?
Right, so let me write what he just said. So we start with a small cost, we apply the rule, which brings us to a higher cost, and we drop this plan. But look what happens. If we had made one more step, then we could have gotten to a C double prime that is even better than our C. So this is that's a danger of pruning too early. So this is why it's okay sometimes to accept these local increases and continue the search. This reminds you of a different course where they study these kind of problems in detail. Which one?
Algorithms.
It's not algorithms.
AI.
No, AI. This is a search problem in AI. That's exactly what they do. And they have various techniques for overcoming this approaching a search problem. So nobody took a course in AI here?
No one passed it.
I don't believe this. You probably didn't take it. So optimization is an instance of a search problem. Apparently, however, the database people, they didn't really borrow too much from the AI field, just because this is such a particular problem in itself. But some of the techniques that they use, they have similarities in AI. So the techniques that are discussed, let me see here, are things like hill climbing. What is hill climbing?
They're at the bottom. Look for local maxima.
Yeah, you always know. Let me redraw this. So now we're looking a goodness function. So how good quality. So let's look at the quality of a query. Initially, it's high, but then it decreases. And we don't like this, so we always want the quality to increase, right? This is hill climbing. But what's the problem with this approach? What we showed before, sometimes you decrease it, but if you continue one more step, then you increase it again. This suffers from the problem of a local minima. There are others, branch and bound. So you just consider different, essentially, this cost. Since nobody seems to get excited about these buzzwords, why don't I just move ahead? What I'm going to show you is dynamic programming, which essentially tries to enumerate all of them. But on this slide are some techniques for avoiding to expand the entire plan. So instead of storing the entire plan, we can do this. In the top-down approach, we represent the top portion of a plan. So we have some joins, and here we just say there is some continuation which is a query without specifying how that query is going to be evaluated yet. it makes a lot of sense when you think about joins. If there are many joins left to be done in this blue box, right, then I'm just avoiding to write down how these joins are being, in what order to do them. But I'm going to express that remaining query in SQL, for example, in SQL. What this saves us is that now I only need to represent the top portion of the plan and store this one. So it reduces the space. Because if I decide that this top portion doesn't look good, then I can throw this partial plan, and I don't have to do all the expansions and figure out that all of them are bad. In bottom up it's vice versa. So here the top is a black box, but we have kind of decided on the plans at the bottom. Same thing here. This is actually the one we are going to discuss. Once we figure out that a partial plan is bad, there is a better way, then we don't have to examine any bigger plan where the same partial plan occurs. Okay, so I'm going to show you a concrete algorithm which is based on dynamic programming. It is crisp, it's simple. It was so crisp and simple that people stuck to it for about 15 years, since the late 70s when systems R was first implemented, until essentially the late 80s when people came up with a better query optimizer in principle, and then it was commercially available only in the mid 90s. So what this does is that it focuses on the join reordering problem. No group bys, no nested subqueries. Actually, in System R, they did support nested subqueries, but as nested loops. So they did not go inside the subquery to further optimize it. They did not try to discover that the subquery can be flattened. So they focused on this basic question. If I have a select from where query that specifies many joins and some selections, what is the best order to for those joins that will result in the cheapest plan? But what do we do with selections? Well, it's easy. We know that selections have to be pushed down. So this is what they did. They pushed the selections down and they forgot about them. If you need to do an index-based access to that table, then we need to reconsider that particular selection. But it's a local decision. And the projections, they go up. Forget about removing projections. It's not a major difference if you remove a column early or late. So the focus is only on join reordering. It makes the problem much easier to understand. Okay, furthermore, they analyze the kind of join trees that the optimizer would consider. This is a join tree, and unfortunately I have here, you can see the join tree. It's just a particular order in which to evaluate the joins. But they also consider special cases of join trees. Maybe you don't want to consider all of them because there are too many, and it takes forever to inspect all of them. So they considered left deep join trees. And systems are actually only supported left deep trees. Well, there is also the symmetric case, the right deep trees. But as a matter of terminology, if it's not left deep, then people in databases call them bushy, the bushy trees. So again, an important concept in System R, this idea that maybe you want to restrict the class of plans you're considering in order to improve the optimizer. So finally, we know what we're looking for. We have a query that consists of a join of n tables. And we have a cost function that whenever we give it some joins, it will tell us how long it will take to compute those joins. And you have a vague idea how to compute that cost function. You need to decide on the physical operators, and then you, for each join, you just apply the corresponding cost function. And the goal is to find the best join tree for the query. So it's a much cleaner definition of the problem, like the instead of the general query optimization problem. And the solution is deceivingly simple. It's dynamic programming. How many people have heard of dynamic programming before? Okay. The idea in dynamic programming is that you're trying to you store all the small subproblems, because every small subproblem may be reused in multiple larger problems. So you need to store them in memory in order to reuse them. In query optimization, the subproblem correspond to subqueries or to subsets of tables that have to be joined. It's a bottom-up algorithm that constructs a query plan bottom-up. And it's very straightforward. Initially, we compute the best plan for singleton tables, which essentially means for each of them we decide whether we're going to scan it or to use the index lookup. If we also choose a physical plan. In the second step, we consider all joins between two tables. And notice that some of these joins will never occur in the same plan, because here we are using R1 in two places, and this will never happen. But we compute all possible joins between two tables, because we don't know which one of them we are going to use in the end. And then in step 3, we consider plans of size 3, and so on and so on. Okay, so I'm going to show you an example, and that will clarify this. Unfortunately, in order to show you any example, I need to use a cost function. Cost of a plan. So the question is, what is this cost function? And I don't want to go through all the details of the cost function. I'm going to use a very trivial one, which is taken from Allman's book. So from the other textbook. So let me go directly to this one. It's a brain dead function, but it's okay for illustration. It says this: if you have to join two subplans, then the cost of the whole thing is the cost of doing the left plan, of course, the cost of doing the right plan, these two, plus the cost of any intermediate results. If you have to store some intermediate results, then we will penalize you. If you don't have to store intermediate results, then there is no extra penalty. Now, what is an intermediate result? Well, and here is this is a strange rule. It says that if the left plan is a join, then you probably have to compute it first, store it, and move on to P2. So therefore, it will account for the size of P1 to be stored. But if P1 is not a join, if it's a base table, then the cost is zero. I mean, the intermediate result is zero. So just keep in mind this formula, so we can examine an example. So here is my example. So we have four tables, R, S, T, and U. And what we want to do, we want to compute the join between R, S, T, and U. And here is what we need to do. we need to build a table like this in main memory that enumerates all possible subqueries. Okay, until it ends with a complete query RSTU. And for each such subquery, we will compute three things. We will compute its cost, of course, but we also need to estimate its size. And finally, we will retain the best plan. So only the best plan. That's important. So I didn't tell you how to estimate the size. I need to go back. We estimate the size using this magic formula. Again, an invention that we inherited from system R. If you know nothing about a join, how can you estimate the size of a join between A and B? System R said you consider that it's a Cartesian product between A and B, and then you state that only 10% of the of this product survives after you do the join. So it's going to be 0,1 times, actually this is 0,0,1. It says 1%, but in system R I think they had 10%. So 0,0,1 times T of A times T of P. It's just a guesstimate. Okay, so now let's work this out. So the sizes are 2, 5, 3, and 1. So 2, 5, 3, and 1. Right? Good. So what is the size of RS? According to our magic formula, it's a product between the product between R and the size of R and S times 0,0,1. So it's going to be 10, so it's 100k. Right? And the cost is in this case it's 0, because it's the cost of the left operand. And the best plan is well, there is no best plan. There is only one plan. We have to join R and S. So we continue with the others. RT will be 150k. RU is going to be 30k. ST is going to be, this is 150k. So what?
RT 60k.
SU is 50k. RU is 20k. Yes. And TU is 30k. Good. Their cost is always 0, and the best plan is nothing to show. It's always their join. Let's move on to the next set of entries when we compute the best plans for joins of size 3. How do we go about this? How can we decide the best join order for RST? Well, here is a trick. We only decide to what do we apply the last join operator. We apply the last join operator to two suboperands, right? So what can they be? They can be either RS and T, or RT and S, or ST and R. And in this example, I'm assuming that joins are commutative, so I don't need to try the others. But why don't we examine all possible join orders for RS? Well, there is, because RS is very small, but in general, we do not examine all those join orders because we look them up. We look them up in this table. And here we already have the best plan for this subquery. That is the essence of dynamic programming. So let's see how it works. First, the size. What is the size of RS join T? The size of RS is 100k times T, which is 0,0, and which is 1,000. This is 1m. Did I get it? RS and T, sorry. T is 3, it's 3M. What is the cost? If you remember, it's the cost of storing RS. Let me see what they do here. Yeah, the cost of storing RS, which in this case is... $100K, right? And the best plan... well, we don't know the best plan yet. No, I think I rushed here. It's not 100K. Because we need to examine all the other joints. So this is just one joint. What about the next one? What is the cost here? It's 60. And what is the cost here? It's 150. So the cheapest one is which one? It's 60. And the actual plan is RT join S. And now I think you got the idea. We have to continue this way and fill out this table. Let's examine the last entry, RSTU. Once we get here, so we don't have these yet. What are the possible joint orders for RSTU? There will be quite a few, but not too many. So we only look at the last joint. It can be between what tables?
RSTU.
It can be between RS and TU, or RT and SU, RU and ST, and I think that's it, right? Because the others are symmetric.
Couldn't you have three on one side and one on the other?
Right, so now we have to continue with three, so RSTU, sorry, RST and U, RSUT, RTUS, and now here we need to take STUR. So, yep, we do have to examine like seven different plans, but only seven, because we do not further need to examine all possible plans, for example, for RTU, because for the best plan here, we just look it up in the dynamic algorithm table. That's the essence. And we find out that here is a best plan, RTSU. This is the winner. Good. So this is dynamic programming. Now, let's discuss it. How many subplans do we need to store? If the table had, if there are n tables, how long is the table? Unfortunately, we call table two things. If there are n relations in the join, how long is a dynamic programming table? How many entries do we need to compute?
N factorial?
No, let me go back here. I'm looking at this size. How big is this?
Power, right? It's 2 to the power n.
2 to the power n. 2 to the power n. Actually, -1. We don't need the empty set. And actually, we didn't even start with a singleton, so maybe -n if we also eliminate the singletons. But that's a dominant term. It's 2 to the n. How can we improve this? It's still too big. Maybe the user wants to have like 20 joints, a join between 20 tables. 2 to the 20 is a little bit too much. At some point, you're spending more time optimizing than you're spending time executing, and that's not a good idea. So how can we reduce the number of subplans that we are considering? What would you do?
You can pick only certain shapes of trees?
That's actually the easy answer. Pick only certain shapes of trees. But there is a And a simple observation that you can make, if you think about 20 tables that are being joined, does it make sense to consider all subsets?
Well, we talked about the bottom-up approach. We could maybe portion them in two and not worry how to join them.
We partition them in two and we don't worry how to join them? I don't follow.
Well, so just worry about the first 10 and the last 10 separately. Break it up.
We do this already, but you still need to consider all subsets of 10. Yes?
Another possibility is maybe if you consider the tables with small numbers to do all those permutations with them and then leave the big ones kind of by themselves, because if you multiply big ones, you get big numbers with them.
Let me discuss something much more obvious. Look at this one. And this table. This only has three. This joint has only three tables. One of the sets we are considering here is RT. But what does RT stand for? RT, they don't join directly. It still makes sense to join them, but what do we get if we join them? We get the Cartesian product between R and T, only to join later with S. And now when we join with S, we join on two sets of attributes. Right? Both on B equals B and C equals C. Because we have join on B and join on C. So my point is that not every table joins with every table. And many of the plans that we are considering when we blindly enumerate all the subsets will contain Cartesian products. So what many database systems do, they restrict the search to trees without Cartesian product. So in this case, they will not consider RT. And in a case with N joins, if you think that if this is a chain join, if they join in a chain, then the number of sets that it can consider is much, much smaller. Does someone know what is the number of sets? So R1 only joins with R2. R2 only joins with R1 or R3. Every RI, so it's like this, R1 joins with R2, which joins with R3, is a so-called a chain join. Here we have a chain join. R joins with S, which joins with T. If you have a chain join of the 2 to the power n sets minus 1, how many will not have Cartesian product? How many?
N to the n minus 1
cube. Somebody said n, which is close but not correct. Somebody said n cube. Which is still not correct. At Microsoft?
It's like an arithmetic progression of the number of
possibilities. So it's a set which looks like this. It's a contiguous, subsequence of these n tables. How can we then identify such a set? We need to indicate the first position and the last position. An I and a J, both between 1 and n. So how many combinations do we have? Something like n square. And it's actually, it's not exactly, so I can choose any, but then J is restricted. So it's more like n times n minus 2, but n choose 2. Much fewer than the 2 to the n sets that we would consider if we do consider Cartesian product. It's a very powerful heuristics. Okay, so does everyone buy that it's a good idea to avoid Cartesian products? So now let me tell you what people discovered. They discovered that in data warehouses, actually Cartesian products make a lot of sense. There is one case in which you would like to compute this query by first computing the Cartesian product of R and T, and then joining with S. Well, in a data warehouse, what is a data warehouse?
Well, the data is basically denormalized.
The data is denormalized. Why do we use a data warehouse? To do analysis, to do data mining. We don't do data mining and data analysis on the production data. You don't want your supermarket cashier to freeze just because somebody right does an association rule data mining task. Instead, we copy the data from the production databases like overnight. We copy this to a different database, which is the data warehouse. We may organize it differently for data mining, like we did organize raw stat data. We had to denormalize it. And now there we can run our group by queries and our data mining algorithm. Now the data warehouses, they tend to have a very particular schema, which is called the star schema. Because they tend to look like this. Think of a data warehouse for a chain of supermarkets. What they're interested in is analyzing their sales of their individual sales. So they will have a big, so-called big fat table of sales, where they really record every single transaction. Every time somebody buys from any of their stores in the country, there will be an entry here. And it's usually also wide because they keep all the information. They want to find an association between whatever is interesting. But in addition, to make this a little bit smaller, they also have foreign keys to so-called summary tables. For example, there might be a table of all the products that they keep. Products. You only need one entry for whatever, diapers, right? Which tells you the price, the manufacturer, and many sales, they refer to diapers. Similarly, you have one entry for the employee, for whoever. Whoever completed the transaction, so there will be a foreign key here. And from here, you might have another foreign key into another table. These tables are much smaller. So data warehouses, they tend to have a star schema because there is this big table sitting in the middle. Let me draw it here. There is a big table sitting in the middle with foreign keys into the much, much smaller tables. Okay? This is very typical of data warehouses. Sometimes these small tables, they continue to have foreign keys into even smaller tables, like a per region information or some higher order summary. Then it's called a snowflake schema. But let me skip the snowflake and let me go back to the star schema. I'm going to show you something interesting. So think about this query as being your typical query on a data warehouse. It takes a big table in the middle, like find me all the sales, and then it joins with two of them summary tables. But usually, you know, these joins, they also have some selections. So it's only looking for a particular type of product in R, and it's only looking for one single employee. It wants to see how is that employee selling diapers. Okay? So R and T are not that big because there is a selection on R on diapers and a selection on T on employee Joe. But S is huge. S has gazillions of sales. So how can you find quickly all the sales that have been made by Joe? Maybe there are three Joes in your table, and that refer to diapers, and you have five types of diapers. So we have five types of five diapers and three Joes, and we have 1 gigabyte of sales. How can we find? How can we do this join?
Join RNT so you only have 15 records.
Exactly. Do the Cartesian product. We get 15 pairs of Joes and diapers. And now we can do this expensive join with 1 gigabyte. It was a very interesting observation that the common wisdom, which is avoid Cartesian products, may not apply in the context of data warehouses. In the context of a data warehouse, because of this, of these star schemas, you may actually want to consider Cartesian products. Good. So more about dynamic programming. So we discussed this already. Okay. So that's the end. That's all I can tell you about dynamic programming. What do real systems do? So both IBM and SQL Server, they have migrated away from dynamic programming because they still have some form of dynamic programming, but they handle much more complex plans than just join trees. Essentially, they handle plans. Usually, they are top-down plans, not bottom-up. The theory for... So how did this start? I think the first extensible query optimizer was invented at the University of Wisconsin. They have a very, very strong database systems group there, and it was invented by DeWitt, who was a database professor, and Götz Grefe, who was a student. And so Götz Grefe, in his PhD thesis, he developed this extensible query optimizer called Volcano. So in the meantime, at IBM Almaden, they felt the same pressure. They had to extend DB2, they had to evolve DB2 from a system R-based optimizer to something that can handle nested subqueries. So there they developed a slightly different approach, but still based on the rules, on a richer representation of queries, that was called Starburst. And they have an intermediate representation which they call QGM. QGM, Query Graphical Model. And I can describe it to you what the essence is. The distinction between these two is more in the details. The high-level idea in Volcano and in QGM is essentially the same. We have a richer representation of queries, and we have a list of rules that is extensible and that will be triggered by the optimizer in order to search the space of all alternative plans. Later, Götz Grefe was hired by Microsoft. And how many people know Götz Grefe? Not that many, but he's in the SQL Server group. So he took Volcano with him, and I don't know what he did inside Microsoft. He probably redeveloped it, but Volcano forms the basis of the SQL Server optimizer. These are the two extensible optimizers out there. Our experience here in the database group, they are much more powerful than the next best optimizer, which is Postgres. Which one is better? It's a matter of debate. Okay, here we are too close to Microsoft to even dare pronounce a different word. From the research papers, these papers are very hard to understand. These are big systems that were described kind of in a hurry in the research papers. I got a high-level idea. From the Starburst papers, the nugget I do remember is query flattening. All those questions that I tend to give in the first part of the course. Can you eliminate this nested subquery in SQL? Well, in Starburst, they do this, and they have these complicated rules. Can you flatten a nested subquery? I'm sure now they do this in Volcano, too. So let me see. Another important thing to know about these rule-based optimizers is that the set of rules is very difficult to manage. The rules, I showed you some simple algebraic rules that make a lot of sense in theory. In practice, these optimizers, they must have much more rigid rules, much more rules that look like programs. They say something like, if you see a join, and if your left operand is a join, and your right operand is not a selection, and there is no group I above you, and you have not applied rule number 35 two steps before, and something else happens, then you can apply this. And then when you want to add another rule, you wonder, will this affect, how will this interact with all the other rules that I already have in my database? Bottom line is that extending an optimizer is very tricky. It's very dangerous. It's not easy to convince these people to extend their optimizer, because they know that if they improve one query, they may damage other queries that have been working fine. So we have been working well so far. Yes.
Can anybody come up with some kind of machine learning to learn those rules and some kind of algorithm to actually learn them? And
that's a good question. How do you learn them? I know that they are designed manually.
Right.
And what happens is, say, but the whole concept, it took me years to appreciate this idea. Now I can appreciate it. The way this works is that they get input from customers. Customers say, we have this query. Look how big it is. It's big, but it does such a poor job. It shows the wrong join order. So they scratch their heads for weeks. And then they discover that they try to write a rule that captures that query. Essentially, that capture what went wrong in that particular query. And this is the big value of these extensible optimizers. You can improve them with this additional wisdom that you gain by examining particular queries. Okay, so I don't think I know more to tell you about this. But still, we have left out a lot of details. For example, just to compute the cost, we always assume that we know how much memory we have. This is no longer the case in a big plan, since you have to divide your available memory across multiple operators. You may not know ahead of time how much memory you have for each individual operator. It depends on the structure of the rest of the plan, so it's a difficult decision. The other decision that I'd like to discuss is this. We have a choice between materializing or pipelining. So let me show you these choices. Here is a plan in which every single intermediate result is materialized. What does this translate into? So all these are main memory hash joins. This means we read the table S and we store it in main memory. And then we read R. We can read this in pipeline fashion. But this bar here says that after we do the join, what do we do with R? We send it to disk. So now we after we finish the join completely, we move on to the next join, which says read T. Construct the hash table in main memory. And now we can start reading this intermediate result, and we send it back to disk. And finally, we do the same thing with U. That's expressed here. So we start by constructing a hash table for S. Then we read R, we join, and then we write. We write this intermediate result into a table called V1. And then we move on, and we write into V2, and finally we return the answer. What is the total cost here? Well, actually, maybe it's too late now to go through the details, but the cost is pretty straightforward. Oops, I don't have it. So we have no choice, but we actually compute it. So what is the cost? Let me erase and see what the cost is. We clearly need to read R, read S, then we need to write and then read again the result of R join S. We don't know how big it is, so I'm going to write it like this. We need to read T, then we need to write and read again the result of R join S join T. And finally, we need to read U, and we're done. That's the cost. How much main memory do we need to perform this plan? M needs to be bigger than what? What needs to fit in main memory at any one time?
The largest of these sets.
Exactly. The largest of, I'm going to write here just S, T, and U. Not what goes on the left, not this part, right? But instead, these pieces need to stay in memory. So this is the these are the blocking operators. The alternative is to do pipelining. Let's see exactly what it means, and it's expressed in this algorithm here, but I'm going to just describe it on the picture. This says read S in memory, organize it as a hash table. Read T in main memory, organize it as a hash table. Read U in main memory, organize it in a hash table. And now we're really happy. What do we do now? We start reading tuples from R, and what do we do with each tuple? We probe it in S, the term is probe. We probe it in S, we may get more tuples, then we take each of them, we probe it in T, we get more tuples, and finally we probe it in U, and we admit the answers. What is the cost of this plan? B of R plus B of S plus B of T plus B of U. Essentially, we save writing and reading two intermediate results. But how much main memory do we need? S plus T plus U. So these are the trade-offs. If we have enough main memory, then we organize it as a pipeline. If we don't have enough main memory, we need to materialize. Okay, in general, pipelining can be much more involved. This is what I was trying to show you here. If we have a bushy tree, then we actually have a new problem. How do we schedule this? In which order do we schedule the pipelines? Yep, writing an optimizer is pretty difficult. So on the next several slides, there is an example, which I'd like to skip. There is too much material that is still uncovered. But please read. This is a great training for, let me write here, good for final. It's simple, but it makes you appreciate the choices that an optimizer has to take, depending on, in this case, it depends on the size of one certain intermediate result. Okay. So I said a little bit earlier that there are three components to an optimizer. There are the set of algebraic laws that go into the optimizer. There is the algorithm that decide in which order to apply these laws, and then there is a cost estimator, some magical math formula that will tell us for every plan how much it costs. The core of the cost estimator is something that estimates the size of the intermediate results. That's what we need to know. We also need to know how much memory we have, but that's too tricky. Mass doesn't help here. We need something else. The focus is on how to estimate the size of the intermediate results, or of the end results. And that's what I'm going to show you next. So remember, in our on our slides, we only keep track of two statistics. And this is the number of tuples for each intermediate result. And then this mysterious V, which says for this intermediate result, how many distinct tuples, how many distinct values do we have for each attribute A? The goal is to compute these statistics on a given plan as we go up the plan. But of course, we will incur some errors. These are going to be estimates. We are going to do our best to estimate them well. So let me skip projection. Let me go directly to selection. That's the first one to worry about. How many tuples will survive the selection? That's a basic question to ask without actually computing it. Well, systems R said 1/10. This is what they had in their implementation, and it works much better than not having an optimizer. Even with this very poor estimation, it still allowed the system R optimizer to choose to avoid the very bad plans. The better estimate is this one. That's something we already discussed. We look at the number of distinct values of the A attribute in C, in A, in R. And then we assume that this number of distinct values is uniformly distributed, so therefore this fraction that's written here will have the value C. So does this formula make sense? Does this make sense to you? Good. What do we do if we have an inequality? Well, systems R said assume 1/3. And what we can do better here is to use some kind of interpolation. We assume that we have the minimum, the lowest and the highest value for the A attribute. And then we just take the fraction of T that is covered by the current inequality. None of these formulas seems very smart, but we don't have a better choice. The real interesting question is, how do we estimate the join? And I need to prepare the discussion, and then I'll show you there is a very simple estimation formula that's actually used in practice. So the place to start is this one. Most joins in practice are between keys and foreign keys, right? So we have so therefore, if you want to know the number of tuples of the join between R and S, how many tuples do we have? Exactly how many we had in R, because every tuple in S, no, there is a foreign key from R into S. So every R will join with exactly one tuple in S. Okay, so is this formula clear? Okay. But here is the issue. Let me think. Okay, so every R belongs to a single S. So if I think about the S as being, it looks like this. There are many R's. I should draw maybe the R on the right direction. The problem is that these are not always atomic tables. They can be other joints. So R may have multiple T's that point to it. And similarly, S might have multiple U's that point to it. So now the actual joint that we have to consider is this, PR join SU. The join is still between a key and a foreign key, between the foreign key in R and the key in S. But the picture is no longer so nice as here. So what we need to find out now is a formula that justifies, I mean, a formula that allows us to estimate the size of a join without making this very strict assumption that every tuple in R refers to a single tuple in S, because that's no longer true. Right? So here, for example, let me use red. Because of these multiple tables, every tuple in S is now replicated once for each U that it joins with. So therefore, when you take an R and join it with S, it will match multiple SU pairs, because the same S was replicated. So here is how to extract from the previous observation some properties that remain invariant even if we do some joins. The two properties are here. Actually, there is only one. The property says that you look at the number of distinct values of the join attribute in R and in S. And if the number of distinct values in R is less than or equal to the number of distinct values in S, this is like a foreign key condition. This is exactly what happens if R had a foreign key into S. And therefore you assume this, that the set of A values in R is included in the set of A values in S. Nothing about uniqueness. Just that that every value indeed appears in the other table. So let's see how to use this. So let's assume this, and now we want to estimate the size of R join S. Let's take one tuple in R and join this tuple with S. With how many tuples will it join?
Yes, sir.
Well, at least I'd like to rule out one thing. It will not join with zero tuples, because of our assumption. We know that every A value in R will occur in S. So it will join with some tuples. With how many? Can you say?
Yes, sir.
No, it's not that simple. It's a selection. So we have so many tuples in S, but we are looking for those that have a particular value of the A attribute, so divided by V of S and A. So this T will join with so many tuples in S. But this is just one tuple in R. How many tuples in R do we have? T of R. So we multiply them, and this is the result. You need to think about it at home. The idea is that it generalizes a key foreign key scenario, but we have to generalize it because that only applies for base tables. It doesn't apply higher up. Notice that it's asymmetric. It's asymmetric because of this condition here. It makes a lot of sense. And in general, we can apply this shortcut. We always divide by the maximum between V of R and A and S and A. Okay, that's an example. Let me skip this. And this you can skip this. This is not on the final. How to do a join on how to estimate the size of a join on two attributes. This gets way too detailed and boring. What I want to show you now in the remaining 5 minutes is how to improve the statistics by using histograms. So here is one histogram. We have a table employee with several attributes, and we maintain detailed statistics about the salary. So what do? We take this, the range of salaries, we split this into ranges of the same width, and for each of them we store the number of tuples. It's pretty straightforward. This offers a better approximation for this allows us to make better approximations for selection than the simple than this simple thing here, T of R divided by V of salary of R and salary. Yes.
So does the database create these things on the fly, or do you?
So when are the histograms created? What do you know about this? When you update the statistics, you have to tell the system to do this. They are not maintained dynamically. If you do an insertion or a deletion, the histograms are not necessarily automatically updated. And that's because it's not always obvious how to do it. For example, in this case actually it's obvious. You could maintain them. But the system doesn't maintain them automatically, just because that would slow down. What I wanted to show you now actually is how to compute this. How do you estimate the number of entries for which the salary is equal to $15,000 from employee?
Well, you know it can't be any bigger than 200.
Sorry?
Well, you start by knowing that it can't be bigger than 200.
It falls into this bucket. That's my point. Well, we have the formula at the bottom. So what we need to know now is the number of distinct values of salary in the first bucket. Here again, histograms kind of differ on what they store. In the figure here, I showed you the number of records. But they can equally store the number of distinct values of that attribute in that particular range. And in that case, you can estimate the size of this selection better. If you just have the number of records, then this doesn't help you too much. Then you need to make a determination how these 200 records are spread across a wide range of 200 salaries, which is not easy. Okay. Last idea that I want to show you. So skip this. This is not on final. No joins between histograms. The last idea I want to show you is the distinction between EQ width and EQ depth. The histogram I showed you earlier is called EQ width. And this is because every bucket covers a range of the same length as any other bucket. What is an EQ depth?
It's a quanta.
So in the sense that every bucket has the same, approximately, the same number of records. Which one do you think gives better approximations to estimates?
Good.
The EQ depth. That's a better one. There is a long theory of histograms and how to use them in database systems. It gets pretty boring. The only much more exciting direction that I've seen in the research literature is something that tries to exploit the correlations that occur naturally between attributes. The problem with histograms is they can only store efficiently statistics about a single attribute. Where the histograms do poorly is to estimate a selection on two attributes. I want all persons living in Seattle and that have a certain salary. You have two separate histograms, one on cities, the other on salaries. How do you combine that information to do this selection? And usually systems assume independence, and then they just multiply the probabilities, which is a bad choice. How can you maintain correlations? This is where it gets much more blurry. And the paper that I've seen uses Bayesian networks to do a better job. Okay, folks, I think it's getting late. I'm not going to start the last part that I had planned for today. I'm going to leave this for next Tuesday. Next Tuesday is our last lecture. My plan is to have a brief discussion of database tuning and physical design, for which I have the slides prepared for today. And then I still want to talk about database security, which is a very fun topic. And I have to tell you there are many completely different ideas and facts. So that's going to be a fun lecture. And then we will have a final review. And that's it. Do you have any wishes for next time? Is there anything that you would like to discuss?
Probabilistic databases.
Probabilistic database. Good. Thank you. I will. This is my. I would love to talk to you about probabilistic databases, and I will do this. Okay. Then have a good night.
Good night.